Dr. Emmanuel Maggiore is a software engineer, writer, and speaker who's on a mission to help develop a more balanced view about the tech and AI industries in the midst of all this relentless hype. He's recently been called the AI Hype Buster, which honestly is a pretty cool nickname, not to mention a role that seems to be critically lacking in the public sphere. He's also the author of the books Smart Until It's Dumb, I love that title, and the latest one, which is called Siliconed. Emmanuel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm glad to hear someone's calling me that. I didn't know.
Yeah, you're doing a debate recently, and that's how they introduced
you. Okay, yeah, I remember now.
I was like, yeah, I'm totally stealing
that. Yeah, okay, cool.
Let's start with the study that's been making the rounds in the media recently. They did a survey asking people whether they think the current large language models are conscious, and this is what they came up with. So I'm going to read the excerpt now. 2/3 of people surveyed in the study think that artificial intelligence tools like ChatGPT have some degree of consciousness and can have subjective experiences such as feelings and memories, according to a new study from the University of Waterloo. So the majority of people out there think that artificial consciousness is, at least to a degree, already here. What do you think about that?
It's a very complicated question, right? It opens a can of worms in terms of a lot of people have been speaking about the topic of consciousness for decades now in the philosophy of the mind kind of, you know, sphere. And I don't think anybody knows the answer. What consciousness is, for starters, what is consciousness, right? What is it? And when does it happen, right? We don't even know why general anesthesia works, right? So we know it does work. It's a correlation. We see we put these substances, right, in your blood and or we make you inhale this gas and then your consciousness stops, right? And then you're awake after your surgery a while later. But nobody really knows the mechanism, which is fascinating, right? So we use it, thank God, right? But we don't really understand it. And part of the reason is that we don't really know what consciousness is, where it sits. And there's a whole spectrum of opinions. For some people, you know, it's called panpsychism. So it's this idea that consciousness arises from computation, from the act of calculating things, if you want. But then you could think of a bucket of full of water, you know, the molecules are bouncing around and we could imagine that they perform a calculation as they bounce around, right? So this bucket of water would be conscious, right? Not the same consciousness maybe that we imagine ourselves, the one we have, but it would be a degree of consciousness, right? That's called panpsychism. Other people at the other end of the spectrum, they think, you know, consciousness happens on biological brains, you know, made of biological cells only. And you know, then they fight against each other, you know. The ones that criticize panpsychism, they tell them, oh, that's ridiculous. You're telling me that water can be, or paint on the wall can be, you know, conscious, or a thermostat, you know, it's a machine, it performs the calculations, it's conscious. But then the other way around, those that believe it's a biological thing, they're called meat chauvinists or, you know. So I don't think the debate has settled either way, right? What we're witnessing now is this very interesting phenomenon of having a machine that produces very, very convincing text, right? So do these calculations then, do they qualify for, you know, consciousness that would get close to our consciousness? For those who belong to that camp, you know, those who believe that consciousness is computation. But I have to say that there are a lot of people who don't believe that, right? Some people think that there's even something non-computational that happens inside our brains. And, you know, someone who's defended this ideas for years was Roger Penrose. I think is still defending his point of view. So he's this physicist who's been saying for years that there's something in our brains, a physical action that hasn't been discovered yet, something related to quantum mechanics that is not something you can simulate with a computer. So then, you know, consciousness is not computational. So, you know, he wouldn't probably agree with this idea that ChatGPT, for instance, is a conscious thing. But the thing is, like, I don't know. What can I tell you? I can tell you there are different opinions. I do tend to get this intuition that Roger Penrose is up to something, even though he's been criticized quite a lot. You know, that they found flaws in his, you know, his reasoning and stuff. I do tend to get this impression that our consciousness and even our intelligence, they're kind of related, and they're something special that we haven't yet cracked, you know. And these hallucinations that happen in AI when it gets it totally wrong, and it kind of tells you, oh, okay, this is just repeating stuff. It's not really smart. It's a bit of an illusion. And they kind of maybe reveal that there's something missing, and maybe that's why it's not really conscious. But I don't know. I think that you can get every possible answer about this, because you can define consciousness any way you want. You can say a rock is conscious because there's some computation happening inside it, you know, or a bucket of water. So in that sense, yeah, definitely ChatGPT will be conscious.
Yeah, I hosted a pretty renowned consciousness researcher called Anil Seth on the podcast a while back. He's also from the UK.
Yeah.
And he said that we often make this mistake that we kind of equate intelligence with consciousness, that and then apply this to ChatGPT, for example. And then, you know, ChatGPT 25 is going to be so smart, then consciousness is just going to be turned on.
Right.
And he said it just doesn't work that way. He also does a lot of experimentation.
Okay.
And that's a very reductive view of consciousness. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was an interesting take. But what do you think? Why do so many people then think that, you know, these LLMs are already at least semi-conscious? What's the mistake that we're
making? I would like to see that study, you know, to see who they ask the question to. Because I think what happens with all the hype around AI, you know, I think it happens for different reasons, but one of them is that people, sometimes they benefit from the hype. They work in a certain field and they want it to be hyped up, right? So saying, oh yes, this is conscious, is could be a way of, you know, bringing attention to your field, right? And also I feel like with AI, there's this fascination with machines that could mimic humans or act like humans. We've seen all these sci-fi movies, and you have, you know, the Terminator.
Oh, yeah.
And Ex Machina, Her,
Blade Runner, here we go.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this fascination, almost like a desire for AI to be conscious, because it's so cool. I think that's what these people think. So maybe it's wishful thinking in a way also, the kind of, you know, but maybe they're right. I don't know. Maybe there is a level of consciousness defined some way, you know, but can we ever tell though? It's not something we can test, right? So
you do admit this possibility.
Yeah. But okay. I think it's
interesting.
Almost, yeah, I do. But I almost think it's tautological, in the sense, if I define consciousness as computation, then yes, there is computation. So there's consciousness, right? If I think, for instance, that it's a valid point. If I think that any degree of computation kind of enacts some sort of consciousness, then a thermostat is conscious by that definition, but to a very low level, a very different kind of conscious power.
I see what we're doing. So we're kind of like bringing the definition to such an elementary level that I can say that my lamp is actually conscious. And then,
you know what?
By comparison, ChatGPT is obviously conscious then.
Exactly. And you know what? It sounds a bit silly, but it's an argument that a lot of people have made, you know? And if you follow this logic, you can see that it's sometimes you get there quite easily, because you could think of your brain as a computer, right? Every neuron is a computer, like tiny computer performing a calculation. If that's true, you know, we need to see about that. But then you can replace each neuron by a microchip, you know, or you can just connect that with a radio transmitter to a person somewhere else with a notebook. Doing the math, you know, let's assume they do it very quickly, and then they calculate the result of the calculation of the this program, and they send it back to you with a walkie-talkie, and then you insert that into the brain. So this consciousness, if it's enacted by this computer program running in the brain, it doesn't actually have to run in the brain. It could run like anywhere, right? And then you could switch one neuron off at a time, right? You could say, okay, I'm going to make the program simpler, right? Not all the way to a thermostat, but we can little by little get there because I just remove a neuron from the brain, right? So if I remove a neuron from your brain, are you less conscious? Probably not, maybe a little bit. I don't know. But if I keep doing that, does your consciousness fade, right? So if consciousness is a question of complexity, then it should kind of fade. So there are lots of thoughts experiments around this. There's a book I recommend called The Conscious Mind. It's by David Chalmers. And it's a very good book that walks you through all these experiments and thought processes. And he tells you different angles or stories about this, right? And that's why you say, do I agree that ChatGPT could be conscious? Well, yeah, philosophically, if you think that consciousness fades depending on the complexity of a calculation, then yeah, potentially. What I always like to stress out here is that all these thought experiments, they assume that our brains or neurons, they're computers, digital computers, right? That you could just replace with something else. Or Roger Penrose, he goes deeper there and he says, you can't do that. You can't replace a neuron with microchip because it's not really a digital computer, right? So then, but I think it's a fascinating philosophical debate. Yeah,
it is. But I think probably, if I can speculate, when they were asking these people, artificial consciousness, these people, when they were responding, they probably didn't have in mind this sort of philosophical abstract consciousness. They were probably more thinking in the vein of something that would resemble our own consciousness. Right?
Well, if that's the case, I am a lot more skeptical. Okay. When you see how those systems work, like LLMs,
yeah,
they're fascinating. They definitely have internal states that represent abstract things, like maybe the size of objects or things like that. But when you look at how they're designed, they're machines to kind of disambiguate words, right? So you take one word, you take all the previous words in a context window, and you try to kind of find relationships between the words and disambiguate a word just to predict the next word, because that's what they do. They always predict the next word. And it seems a bit too simple. And I could quote maybe Jan LeCun on this, who is the inventor of deep learning, if you want. And he was saying at a podcast with Lex Friedman, he was saying that we don't always think in terms of words, for starters, right? The way we often think about stuff or solve a problem, you can imagine maybe an object, moving around. You don't necessarily do words all the time. LLMs, they're framed as a word prediction problem, right? Another thing, these LLMs, they have a fixed number of steps they use to solve a problem, which is always to predict the next word. When we reason, we seem to use a different amount of resources depending on how difficult the problem is. So when a problem is difficult, we do some pondering and we spend time and effort. So it seems that the way we operate, again, maybe I'm conflating intelligence with consciousness here, but I feel like the way we operate, the way we think, doesn't seem to be quite just about predicting the next word based on previous words and a fixed number of steps, right? So I'm a bit skeptical about, having a consciousness that is similar to ours inside those machines. I would say that that's probably not the case.
Let's go a little bit back. At the beginning of your reply, you said that these large language models, they have internal states. That freaked me out a little bit. I'm not going to lie. What did you mean by that? Because it sounds so human, having an internal state.
So, an LLM, it takes an input and it produces an output. And there are many layers of processing in between. These layers, they basically transform numbers. When in the beginning of the LLM, you take a word, there's actually a dictionary that maps every possible input, every possible word or piece of word, to a list of numbers that try to represent the meaning of the word, right? You can imagine one number tells you, is this an animal? The other one, does it have four legs? Is it blue? We don't really decide, the AI engineer doesn't decide these topics because it's all learned kind of from using machine learning, but we can imagine mapping words to topics, okay? And then what happens as the layers, as you move through the layers, is that there's contextualization. So every word looks at other words to improve these few numbers that represent the topic, right? So we can think of these numbers as an internal state that describes what this word talks about, right? I often give this example of, I inputted the dog's bark was barely, and the system told me audible, right? But if I say the tree's bark, mm-hmm. The word bark can also refer to a tree. The trees.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, like the coating of a tree is called the bark.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Bark.
Yeah, yeah. So if you say the tree's bark was barely, then the LLM will tell you visible, right? And what happened here is that the word bark initially in the LLM, the first time it's encoded into topics, it's done in isolation. So you don't know if you're talking about a tree or a dog because you haven't seen the rest of the sentence, right? That's the first attempt to represent the meaning of the word. And then as the system looks at other words in the, in the context, it starts improving this representation. So you can imagine that this list of numbers that represents the meaning of bark becomes more dog-like if the word dog is somewhere in the sentence, right? And it becomes more tree-like if the word tree is somewhere in the sentence. So this is the internal state of the LLM, right? And the state will represent topics that are useful to, if you want to understand a word or to make predictions about what comes next from a word. And because the topics are kind of picked automatically through this learning process, we don't really know what they are, and there are so many, right? But they could represent things like the size of an object, if that's useful, right? In the case of bark, we would imagine that there needs to be some sort of animal kind of thing going on, or tree thing going on, right? So these are the internal states. So when some people say, I had a discussion about this yesterday, when they say, this is just predicting statistical patterns of which words go together.
It does sound like that a little
bit. It is. So it's technically, it's like that. Yeah. But we need to also acknowledge that there are many layers of processing. So in between, there may be more insightful things going on, right? Some abstractions, some level of abstraction, perhaps the wrong one, right? So there was this system, image categorization system, that they saw that it failed to detect a cow if it was standing on the beach. There was a picture of a cow on the beach and it failed, right? The reason was that the system had learned, if you want, that a cow with grass underneath is a cow, right? That the two things go together because that's what happened most of the time in the training data. So these systems do have internal states that represent certain abstract things, right? I don't think they go that far, We it's still the system trying to put together text based on how text has been put together before by people, but there are internal states representing more complicated things, right? So I think, there's a mix of the two.
I've heard it put many times that we don't actually know what's going on inside, under the hood, but you broke it down in a very nice and tangible fashion. Even I kind of got the gist, and I have no experience or education in this field. So we actually do know what kind of operations bubbling.
What happens is that, and in fact, whenever you, and this is something I find myself telling people a lot, whenever you design a successful AI system, based on machine learning, you need to create a solution that works very well for the task. And you need to use assumptions of how to perform the task. So this idea of I'm disambiguating words based on the context, it's all our thoughts of how it's best to solve the problem. And they're encoded in a computer program. We know exactly what it does. The thing is that some of the operations are configured by numbers, right? So imagine a list of numbers that tell you, how much weight should I give to this when I disambiguate that, right? How do I combine these numbers that represent one word with the previous word, right? Those are the things that, and these operations, they have a few numbers. We can think of multiplication. It's very basic operations. Anyone can kind of understand how an LLM works if you go through it step by step. So let's say you multiply these numbers by these other numbers and you add them together to calculate how two words are related. But when you multiply these numbers, sometimes the engineer that builds this, they put question marks in the computer program. So that these numbers, I am not going to define them, right? I will let the computer do that during learning. So we can think of machine learning as creating a template of a computer program in a lot of detail, but leaving all these numbers, which are called parameters, we leave them undefined. But they're put there with an intention, right? So a very clear example is in image categorization. We apply image filters, lots of filters, to highlight things in an image. But instead of us, the engineers, saying, okay, this filter should highlight vertical lines in a picture, I say, okay, apply a filter defined by these 9 numbers. Filters are often defined by 9 numbers, what they do, right? But I leave them as question marks. During the learning process, I will discover what these numbers are, which means that I let the computer pick its own filters. But it doesn't do anything it wants. It picks filters. We're telling the computer, you need to filter an image many times, you know, progressively to highlight patterns and stuff. There's a lot of people get this impression that the computer learns by itself. It doesn't. The computer learns these things that we left as blanks in a template that is actually it's a recipe of how to solve the problem, right? That's how it works. And the success of LLMs came after someone invented a better recipe to solve the problem compared to previous ones, right? It just worked better. It was more aligned with how we should probably be solving this problem.
Would you say that there is something essential that we kind of don't understand when I'm saying we, I mean the public at large, not you, the experts, that we don't understand when thinking about these ChatGPTs, large language models, something that makes us come to these kind of erroneous conclusions? Or let me put it this way, what do we get most wrong about AI tools such as ChatGPT?
I think one of them would be that these hallucinations or epic mistakes that happen quite often, that they're just a bug, they're going away. It just needs another year and it's going away. Because I don't think that's the case. And I've been saying that for quite a while. Like Jan LeCun says that, like a lot of people in the field are saying that. We don't know how to fix these hallucinations, right? They're kind of a feature of the way we build LLMs right now, or we build AI in general. You know, we teach the computer to do the job by imitating other people have done the job. We give lots of examples to the machine, but we know that it, once in a while, it errs badly. It makes these stupid mistakes, and we don't really know how to. You can fix certain mistakes, but then others pop up, and there's a long tail if you want a very uncommon situations, which is with this fails, right? When you learn by example, like we do at the moment, whenever something's quite out of the ordinary, a situation that is very, very far away from what you have in your data, then the system often fails. But there's no solution because we can't collect data for every possible thing that could happen, you know? And for some reason that we still don't understand, humans are actually pretty good at coping with those situations, right? Like when we're driving, there was this example of, I think, was it a Cruise or a Waymo car? May have been a Waymo car. One of those self-driving cars. A few months ago, it hit a truck that was being towed in an awkward position. They had attached something not the way you usually do it, right? And because it's such an uncommon situation, the AI didn't recognize it and just hit it head on. And then 10 minutes later, another car did the same. So it hit it twice, different cars, right? And when you look at what the company said about this, they kind of blamed it on the way the car was being towed. They're like, oh, it was such an uncommon way. And this is not actually the way you're supposed to do it. Yeah, but as a human, I would have recognized that this was a truck that I can't hit. You know what I mean? Even if I've never seen it in my life. And that's what's so dangerous. We're creating these systems that are so big and have used so much data that we get the impression that they're infallible. They can just cope with any situation. And then at one point, they don't, right? And I think we don't know how to fix it. So it may not happen anytime soon.
Speaking of hype, which you mentioned a bit earlier. I've used ChatGPT-3, I believe it was, a couple of times when it came out, and I was very impressed initially, like probably everybody else. I'm not going to lie. The feeling of a machine kind of answering back in a coherent human fashion did make the whole thing feel a little bit freaky, you know. Having said that, I also have to add that this kind of novelty factor quickly faded away, and the whole thing just started to seem a little bit gimmicky, like an interactive parrot version of Wikipedia or something. Yeah. Now, I understand, you know, someone using this thing for the most boring tasks imaginable to humankind, like writing cover letters when applying for jobs. You know, you have to chuck out 200 of these sometimes, or book summaries for high schoolers who don't want to do their homework or something. But apart from this sort of almost trifle, its functionality seemed kind of limited. Now, I'm not a programmer, so I can imagine that maybe programmers have better use of this thing. Probably not. Am I kind of totally wrong in being so judgmental here, and ChatGPT is on the verge of curing cancer and solving climate
change? Definitely not. So I think I was very surprised when I used it the first time. So it's very impressive. It definitely has uses that are wonderful. You know, it's definitely here to stay. A lot of people are using now LLMs on a daily basis to do certain things. I sometimes use them. But, and I like that you use this word gimmick, because I think they are quite gimmicky. And I think one of the biggest problems we've seen in the business world with AI is that they thought that there would be so many commercial applications that would arise from LLMs that would be successful. It almost sounded like it was an absolute fact that a lot of companies would make a lot of money from creating an LLM, wrapping it around, you know, just create like an LLM wrapper and sell that, you know, and we're going to solve so many problems and people are going to lose their jobs. And I think it was very naive, because I didn't see at the time, and I said it for a while, and now, you know, investors are saying it, but I thought, what are these obvious applications? When you have a system that hallucinates a part of the time, you know, you can use it for many things. It kind of prevents you from using it in many cases. And also, people don't always want to interact in natural language with computers. That was also, to me, was very naive. And I remember this example of, I think it was, I don't remember who it was, maybe it was Shopify, but there was this API for, you know, for shopping or whatever. And they showed this new system where people would, how they would shop, right? And the person was, they would type in, I wanted to throw a Japanese themed dinner party at home. What do I need? And then the chatbot would reply, and then it would be, oh, if I want to buy a knife, what kind of knife should be? And it was all this conversation. Yeah. And I was like, I would never want to shop that way, you know? And then I saw the comments to the video, and people were like, it takes a lot longer than actually, you know, and most people, they know what they want to buy, and they don't want to be using natural language for it, right? And I've seen that quite a lot. You know, even startups try to build a product that has nothing to do with natural language by taking a request from a user, converting it into a sentence, you know, a prompt. That's what a lot of people are doing. And then getting this prompt back, you know, but then their users didn't really want to see a prompt, like a text. So they parsed this, they converted it into a structured format to display on this app. But there were some glitches, because sometimes it returned data, you know, in different ways. I couldn't make it work very, very well. But again, I thought there's this exaggeration about how much people want to actually use natural language systems that hallucinate, you know. So there are uses for it, but are we going to make billions from it? You know, I don't think so.
Now, the other kind of sensationalist take that's all over the place is that Skynet is on the verge of waking up and murdering us all. A lot of very kind of intelligent and knowledgeable people within the industry are making these sort of catastrophic predictions. Do you believe AI is an existential threat to humanity as it stands today?
So I don't think, I think it's not AI by itself, the tool. An LLM is not. It's a tool to predict the next word, right? And we design them very carefully. We know, as I said before, we add lots of layers of processing, and they're about disambiguating words and stuff. what I think is a threat is believing that they're more powerful than they are and connecting LLMs with other systems and just trusting their output. So for example, if you have an LLM that writes software code, right, and then you go and execute the code in a computer without checking whether it has like a security glitch or a problem, right? So I think that is the threat, and believing a bit too much in the power of AI. I said this in the context of self-driving cars before. You know, I don't think we can produce safe self-driving cars that can drive themselves everywhere in a safe way. And the industry is actually failing to do that, and it's not doing well right now because of that. So, but I said at one point, I'm afraid people will deploy self-driving cars that are not really safe, you know, in cities, and they will cause problems. So it's a bit this, I'm afraid of the same with LLM. So we have the system, we generate some code, we execute the code, right? We just, you know, and we've seen some of that. Maybe it's not catastrophic, but there was this lawyer who filed a document in court that included citations to previous legal cases that didn't exist. So they were hallucinations from ChatGPT. He didn't double check it, right? Because he thought it was actually like a search engine, right? And he just filed that in court, and he was fined afterward. We had Air Canada, who there was a customer spoke with the chatbot and asked questions about a refund policy. And the chatbot invented a policy that wasn't true. So how to proceed to ask for a refund. And then when the customer followed the process, the airline told him, no, this is not true. This is not how it works. Our conditions, you can find them somewhere else on the website. He's like, yeah, but the chatbot told me this other thing, you know. And then a judge ruled that Air Canada had to honor the refund, because you can't just, you know, say two different things on your website. And then they kind of removed the chatbot. It's no longer available. It's not catastrophic. Nobody, you know, died from that specific action. But it's, you know, little hints of what could happen if we trust them. Trust them blindly. Yeah, that's my fear.
I see. So you're talking more about some sort of localized scenarios or scenarios that are particular to certain industries that start using these tools and they're not being careful with it. But I suppose what these people that are making these scary predictions mean is more of a sci-fi scenario. And probably in the context of AI waking up like a human and then deciding to killing us all. Basically the plot of Terminator or Matrix.
So I think that's a very interesting exercise philosophically, because it's true that I think there's a tiny bit of, not of truth, but they think about those scenarios from things that are true about AI. So for example, current AI built with machine learning is built to optimize an objective. Right, so you give the computer an objective, and the computer kind of finds its way of fulfilling that objective. So that sounds like you could tell a machine, and Elon Musk said this once, like if you just reduce spam, and the machine will decide to kill people because that would reduce spam. Right? However, what's really naive of this is that, machine learning pursues an objective, but the objectives we make it pursue are very basic. In the case of LLMs, it's predict the next word that is the most likely to happen, right? So it's not, you know, find the best way to reduce spam. It's usually very, very basic and very narrowly defined. And then the things that the computer learns, these parameters, are usually very well-defined things too, right? As we said before, we have these numbers that tell us how to compare words. So it's very, very narrowly defined. The scariest kind of AI that you know, people may evoke when they speak about this is called reinforcement learning. It's a type of AI that learns by trial and error. So it tries an action, measures the effect of the action. So it gets feedback. And you can try random actions to do that. You could think of a robot learning how to navigate a room that tries to go different places. And then it kind of internally ends up building a map of the room, you know. And however, again, it's a bit naive, because the way this works is that you need to code the actions that this robot can take, or the spam filter can take. And they're usually very narrowly focused on the task that you're trying to solve. It's like turn right, turn left, Because if you let it do anything, you know, then it will probably never find anything useful to do, right? So the way reinforcement learning works is, you know, very narrowly defined actions. This machine can try them out with a very narrowly defined objective, you know. So I think if we take these ideas, learning from trial and error and objectives, and we pretend that there are no restrictions, which isn't the case, then yeah, you could, in a sci-fi novel, you can imagine the robot learning something really crazy, you know, about how to do things. But that's not really how it works. And it doesn't work that way, not because we want to restrict them before they go crazy. That's not the way it works. It is very restricted because if we don't restrict the machine, it doesn't learn anything useful, right? So we need to guide the machine, because otherwise it doesn't learn. And that's another misconception, you know, this idea that, again, I said it before, computers learn by themselves. No, they don't. We help them learn a lot, because otherwise they don't learn anything. Yeah.
That's much more humbling than all of these crazy scenarios about by 2027, humanity is toast. You know,
yeah. It's more like a poster. I'll tell you a story. When I was looking for a publisher for my book, Smart Until It's Dumb, I spoke with an agent who was quite a famous agent. He's been involved in some famous sci-fi books. So I was very lucky that he even answered my emails. But he told me, no, your book about AI, nobody will want that book, because the books that sell about AI
are the scary ones.
So you should either make a really scary prediction about the future or a wonderful, amazing prediction about the future. But what you're trying to tell people in this book is that it's not quite like that. It's more like a, you know, giving them a tap on the shoulder. I think that's what he said. And nobody wants to buy that. I would argue that it's not true now, because, you know, after ChatGPT happened, so I had these conversations earlier. I think there's a lot more interest in AI at every level. But and at one point it's like, should I focus this on the dangers of AI? Should I make? And I ended up writing my own book the way I wanted to write it. I remember that. You know, it sells. What sells is this, you know, this outrageous prediction. Yeah.
Right. Well, what calmed me down is when you said that LLMs are basically machines for predicting the next word, which again is much more modest and humbling than some sort of scary robot with a big machine gun.
You know? That's the way the problem is formulated. And the reason they generate entire sentences is because we make the LLM eat its own output, right? So we generate one word, we give it back, we attach it to the end of the sentence, we give it back to the LLM, it guesses the next word, and we keep doing that, you know? I was using ChatGPT the other day, experimenting with it, and I asked about the current weather. ChatGPT can know about the current weather because it's a static model that it models language, you know, how guessing the next word. It can access the next weather. But what they did is in the prompt, they tell ChatGPT, if you need to search something on Google, say it this way. Tell me what you want to search. And there's a wrapper around the LLM that it intercepts this message that's like, I should search about the weather on Google. And then it goes and searches for that on Google. And then it inserts the response of the weather, the current weather, into your prompt. Right? So we're using a trick to make you believe that it's more than this static model of language that predicts the next word, right? But it's a trick. And it happens outside the LLM, technically, you know, this. And they're transparent about it. So when you do that, you see a little sign saying, we're searching the web, you know, we search these websites and stuff, right? So, but a lot of these enhanced capabilities of LLM, they're added outside the model. You know, it's how we use them in a cool way. It's not that they intrinsically can do that. You know, like there's a little agent there, like a little demon that goes and searches the web. You know,
I've recently read another very interesting article that stipulated that we could run out of data to train AI by 2026 or something. Would that mean that the development of AI would come sort of to a standstill and we'd basically just be stuck with, I don't know, ChatGPT-7 or something?
So I read that article. Yeah, it makes a good point. So first of all, current LLMs, the ones that are successful commercially, like ChatGPT, they've been trained in two phases. They've been trained not just once. So the first phase was to gather a lot of data, publicly available data from the internet, including books, included pirated books, hundreds of thousands, lots of data without any authorization, right? So they gather all that data and they train this machine to predict the next word. The system sometimes didn't work very well. It was what they called misaligned. So it didn't follow instructions properly. It didn't. So that what they started to do afterward was to create manual data by writing examples by hand to fine tune the system. You know, some people, you know, it's been said they hired people in Kenya for like $2 an hour to write examples. So they already got a bit stuck from using all this public data. And they started to manually write it. You know, when it refuses to answer an inappropriate question, that's all done manually. But even the solutions to very common problems that it didn't solve very well before, they've been trying to adjust them manually. So they already hit, if you want, a ceiling in that now we need manual data, which takes a lot of time. But yeah, so in a few years, and what this article says is in a few years, the amount of public data available that exists in the world, you know, we will have used all of that or a data set of that size for the first phase of training the LLM, right? So we'll exhaust that. So yeah, that will be a problem because how do we get more data, right? It could be private data, but that's not very scalable, right? And then again, there's also this problem that there's a second phase already where we need to kind of do things manually. So the data problem will be on both fronts, right? So that means that, and all of this has to do with long tail of cases, right? AI needs to see examples of things to learn from. As I said before, the toad, you know, the car being towed, that was a very uncommon scenario. How are we going to cover very strange things if there's no more publicly available data to gather and we need people to kind of write things down by hand? How are we ever going to generate enough data? So I think, yeah, we may hit the bottleneck very soon.
And then what's going to happen? Where are we going to go from there?
We need innovation. We need a new, I don't know if we need it, but what would need to happen is the development of a new methodology that goes beyond the current machine learning approach, this learn by trial and error or learn by example kind of thing, from data collected from the internet. So there needs to be a change in methodology. If you want a discovery of a new way of doing things, just like this transformer architecture, which is what LLMs use, you know, when it was invented, it made language models a lot better, right? We need a new step. And the thing with innovation is that we can never predict when it will happen. A lot of people say, oh, it's a matter of time. It's been going on. It's been growing so fast that it's a matter of time. Yeah, but you know what? It doesn't work that way. If you can estimate how long it will take, you can only do that when you have an idea of how to solve the problem. And if you did, you would have billions from venture capitalists that they would have given you the money to do it, you know? Think of nuclear fusion power. They've told us for decades that's around the corner.
Yeah, it's always 10 years away or something, they say, right?
It's always 10 years away. And that's because you can't predict innovation, right? And I think the next step in LLMs or in AI will take place when there's a new way of framing the problem, a new methodology that we discover, we invent. Will that happen in 1 year, 10 years, 20 years? I don't know. I can know. Yeah. And it happens randomly, innovation, right? Look at, you know, Einstein. He discovered the theory of relativity when he worked for the patent office, you know, in his spare time. It was very hard to know when those things happened.
Yeah. Another question completely is, do we even want that? But maybe that's a conversation for another time. I wanted to ask you the following. I used to study screenwriting. I'm still kind of connected to the film world. And there's a big fear there that, you know, ChatGPT is going to start writing scripts and doing all the jobs that we want to do. That's really making everybody unemployed and we're going to be left with the shitty jobs. Do you think AI will ever be able to create convincing original pieces of art or pop culture? I mean, for example, do you think it could write a better last season of Game of Thrones than the one we got? Okay, maybe that's not that hard, but you know what I mean.
I haven't seen that show. Actually, I need to. It's one of those shows that I have to see. But look, I've been actually speaking about screenwriting specifically a lot in the context of AI lately, because I've heard this before. You know, it's screenwriters are going to be replaced by AI. And what I say about that is that before we judge a certain job, we need to see what the job entails, right? What does it actually take to write a good script? And there are certain jobs where there's an excellence gap, if you want. You can do it in an okay way, or you can do it in an excellent way, which usually involves this human touch. We'll go back to that in a second. But writing a good script tends to be the kind of thing that, you know, people punish you, the audience, unknowingly. They punish a lazy script very badly. Shows get canceled all the time. So what does it take to write an excellent script? And there's one example I like to... There's a show, Homeland. You know, this American show, Homeland.
The spies, right?
The spies. Every season kind of spoke about very relevant stuff, things that were happening in the world. And that made it very relevant and, you know, compelling to the audience. But that wasn't an accident. Every year, before writing the following season, the writers and even the crew, the actors, everybody got together with people who had worked for the CIA or intelligence consultants, and they did what they called spy camp. So they literally spent a few days together brainstorming what would be in the news the year after so that they could write a relevant show. Think of Friends. It was shot in front of a live audience because they wanted to see if people laughed. When people didn't laugh at a joke, they asked people how the joke could be changed. They did like a show of hands, you know, where did you not understand the joke? Did you understand the joke but thought it wasn't funny? So, and based on the feedback, they rewrote the lines on the spot. And the reason I'm telling you these stories is that it's very easy to say that AI will replace screenwriters if you've never met a screenwriter and see what it actually takes to write a good show. Right? And with all of these professions, like screenwriting, but writing in general, I'm a writer of books, but copywriters, copy editors, like lots of people in the writing professions. Sometimes the work you do to produce a good product is 90% not writing. It's research, interviews. You know, there's a lot going on that AI can do for you. It's not about the grammar, the words, right? And I think it's also the case with screenwriting. You know, I was watching this show, Dairy Girls, which is a very silly comedy. Yeah, it's a very silly comedy that takes place in Northern Ireland during the conflict in the 90s. And it's a very lightweight comedy, but it also sometimes speaks about what happened during the Troubles, like the political conflict. So how do you write that show without offending people? How do you write a show that is a comedy, but still depicts, if you want, historic events that are very, very controversial without offending either side so that people can actually laugh? And they did a good job of that, you know. And I read an interview to the writer of the show and how the finale of the show, it took many attempts to write it. They had many different versions because they achieved that. And that's why the show became very popular here in the British Isles, if you want to call it that way. But it was also popular in other places. Again, that was 90% not putting words together in a grammatically correct way, right? So I think there's a certain excellence in a lot of work that is ignored by commentators of AI. They're like, oh, AI will do it, you know? But they've never met a person who does that. But at the same time, I can also tell you that there are certain jobs that don't have that excellence gap, you know? You can do it very easily. And I'll give you an example in writing. You know, when people... they pack a website with blog articles that just want keywords in, so you drive traffic, like 20 things to do in Paris this winter, you know. And it's like, it's not curated. It's just a list of things, you know, and it's a travel agency trying to sell you a trip, right? These people, they used to hire freelancers on Fiverr and Upwork to write any article speaking about Paris packed with keywords. They didn't care about the quality, the research. There's no human touch, if you want, there. And they paid very little for those articles. And these people are in trouble now, the ones who wrote this, because they are being replaced by AI. So, and I think that what the difference between that and screenwriting is, you know, in this excellence gap, this thing of, you know, yeah, you can actually write a blog article that is excellent, but the market doesn't care in that sense. The person who buys the blog article doesn't really want an excellent blog article. They just want an article written with some keywords in it. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe a little issue is that you've just kind of talked about, let's say, TV shows or cultural products that are excellent. But there's a lot of stuff that's being produced on purpose that is kind of mid the largest common denominator that people consume. Trash stuff with intentionally bad screenplays. And I've used ChatGPT. Yeah. I asked ChatGPT to write a screenplay, and it was coherent. It sucked. But there was some sort of a structure there. It understood what a screenplay is. And we're kind of at the beginning of this, you know, AI.
So what's your impression as a former screenwriter? What's your impression?
Like I said, it was coherent, which surprised me, but it was very generic. You know, it just used the most generic possible scenes within a screenplay.
Yeah.
But it made me wonder, what's ChatGPT 10 then going to be like? If you keep feeding it screenplays to read, it's probably going to get better and better. And the products...
Except that, as we said a minute ago, there may not be that many more screenplays to feed it, okay. Right?
That's so what I wanted to hear.
Yeah. So it's a good question. I think, again, I don't know much. It's not my industry, so I don't know what consumers want. I am a consumer of shows, though, myself, and... the fact that it's coherent, to me, it's not enough. You know, that there needs to be this soul to a show that's going to make you keep watching it. Just the fact that it looks like a show, because that's what ChatGPT does. It produces a screenplay that looks like a screenplay superficially, but is a proper screenplay. Maybe, I don't know. I grew up in South America, and we had all of these telenovelas. You know,
I'm originally from the Balkans, so people went crazy for Mexican telenovelas.
Yeah,
especially grandmas and older people, pensioners and so forth.
And they do tend to be a lot of the same.
Exactly.
Right? It's the same stories that they're just, they are recycled every time. You know, it's this the maid, that the cleaner who falls in love with this rich guy, you know. So it's always the same story. So I could imagine that maybe you can put something together that is quite similar using AI. Right. So in that case, potentially I can see it.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Like, for example, some sort of straight to DVD Steven Seagal film could easily probably be written by the current GPT.
Yeah. Those kind of cookie cutter action movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just throw all the cliches in there. Steven Seagal's kicking everybody's ass and here we go.
I can see how that could somehow potentially happen. Yeah.
But that's work as well. A lot of people, even though they want to, you know, write more original fare, are kind of condemned most of the time to also write this sort of stuff for money, and they are going to lose jobs if that happens, which is not that fun.
Yeah, it will definitely be a transformation in the job market, but I think it will be at that level, right? So it will be the level of this very generic work that doesn't have the human touch, the research, that it has. Yeah, so I think it will. Yeah, I've spoken with translators a lot lately who reach out to me because
that must be hard. Yeah,
yeah, and and they're going through a rough patch, you know, because of the whole AI thing. And I think there are different kinds of translators. So there's definitely an excellence gap in a lot of their work because, you know, they tell me in literary translation, for instance, we don't translate what the text says; we translate what the text does. Right? ChatGPT often translates what the text says, but we sometimes need to give it a twist because we want to achieve a certain effect on the reader. You know, so there's obviously a lot of merit to what they do. But then, for instance, I spoke with people who translate websites, like a hotel's website, right? And I think they're the ones that are in trouble now. And it's not that they can't do an excellent job. It's that there's not a lot of market value to that excellence. So if you're a literary translator, I think that it's hard to imagine that a reputable publishing house will translate a novel using AI and just leave it like that because they would really want a good translation that people will get very angry otherwise. But when it's translating a website, then who's going to hire a unless it's a really, you know, a website that needs to be very, but I can imagine lots of people just translating their websites. Like if you have like an e-commerce store where you sell t-shirts and you just, oh, it's great. Now I can, you know, create lots of different versions of the store in different languages and I just use AI for it. Yeah. And I think a lot of these people are, sometimes their reaction, you know, some of them is to somehow try to stop this. I don't think that's going to work, you know? I don't think they can just like legally somehow stop it. You know, some of them were telling me the translations I make, I don't want AI to ever be trained from them, which I think is a fair point. I don't want, you know, they don't want to put something on a website that they translated and that being used to train AI. But, you know, even if your data wasn't used, these systems are already working, you know, quite well. And there's a lot of other data they can use. So you're not going to stop it that way. So you probably need to adapt your own work. You need to focus on something with that added value, with that excellence gap, you know, or something that requires really stringent validation. You know, if you're translating the manuals of, you know, of devices or like rockets, or you may need to, you may preserve your job more.
That's a tough conversation. Makes me wonder if we're going to abandon any sort of standards more and more often because of cutting costs, because ChatGPT will be able to do that. And then excellence is just going to become that much more expensive and rare because a human has to do it.
Maybe,
that's a bit of a scary prospect, I have to be honest.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think there will be a bit of a rebound. So I think people will go a bit too far in using AI. And then they will go a little bit back toward humans because they will see that job.
The pendulum swings.
The pendulum, I think, will swing because they will see, okay, people are not liking this much. The audience isn't responding to the script the way I thought they would, you know?
We were talking about feeding data to these models. Speaking of which, what's your take on the recent Scarlett Johansson affair? For those of you maybe who are listening and are not familiar, OpenAI developed a personal assistant voice for ChatGPT, I believe, which is the exact copy of Scarlett Johansson's voice from the movie Her, which apparently is Sam Altman's, the owner of OpenAI's favorite film. They approached her many times and she always declined. That's how the story goes until they, I guess they just sort of tried to see if it sticks, and it didn't because she picked up on it immediately. I have to say, if the story's true, it is a little bit douchey, to be honest. Not a great practice there.
Yeah. If it's true, again, you know, that's why it's controversial, because the voice, yeah, it does sound a lot like Scarlett Johansson, but some people say it's not exactly the same.
Well,
So that could be part of the discussion, right? Did they really try to imitate Scarlett Johansson? But then, you know, Sam Altman tweeted the word "her" a few hours before this was announced, it was released or something, right? Just that word on Twitter, which was quite, you know, okay, this sounds like they may have tried to make it sound like her. I found it very disturbing that she declined and they still did it.
Yeah, you know? Same.
Yeah, they hired another actor, potentially. That's what they said. They hired an actor.
That sounds exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, let's say it sounds a lot like her. But I found it quite disturbing, because even if they're legally entitled to do that, because I had this discussion with people, they were like, oh yeah, but you can just hire an actor and you do the voice. It sounds like her. Yeah, what's the problem? Her voice, you can't copyright a voice, you know? That's what some people were saying. And yeah, even if it's legal, it is disturbing that you ask a person repeatedly and they say no, you know, and then you still kind of go and do it anyway. So I would say that was, I was a bit shocked. I don't think I would have done it myself if I were like, okay, they declined, well, I'm not going to do that. Yeah.
What about the broader point of we just letting ChatGPT swallow our hard-fought knowledge that, you know, these companies then are going to exploit for their own profits? I mean, you said that's legal. Is that legal? Is that a gray zone? Are we doing anything about it? What's the scoop here? Because it sounds also quite shady, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it's to be determined, because the question hinges mostly on the topic of fair use of copyright. I'm not a lawyer, but I'll tell you the things I know. So in my book, I cite other books, right? I quote a passage from another book, and I haven't asked the authors for permission. But that's considered fair use, because my product is not competing against their product, right? You quote a couple of sentences because it's, you know, for my product, but you're not going to not buy their book because I quoted two sentences from that book in my book, right? And that's fair use. And there are lots of lawsuits now. Like we're going to know what's going to happen, I think, in a few months. But there have been a lot of lawsuits against AI companies, and it all hinges on that fair use. For example, the companies that sell stock images, like, you know, Shutterstock.
Yeah.
Their images have been used to train AI systems to produce images. And now people are buying, instead of buying their images, you know, they're just using AI to generate images. And in that case, it sounds to me like they are building systems that compete against the other systems, and they're using their data for it. So we'll see how it goes in court. But that doesn't sound quite like fair use to me, if you know what I mean. I think it's a bit shady. And then with ChatGPT, again, I don't know, because yeah, you get data from a certain website, and what you produce, maybe it's not in direct competition with that website, so it will be considered fair use. I don't know what's going to happen.
Before you cited an example, I don't know if it was your friend or a colleague, a translator maybe, or an author who was like, I don't allow my works to be fed to these machines, or something along those lines. Can you actually do that as somebody who's copyright, or do they actually take that into account? Can you ever know what's going on there?
So we already have a precedent,
which
is with search engines, right? So there was also a big discussion a few years ago about, because search engines need to go through my content to index the content. And some people were not very happy with that. They wanted to be excluded. And there was an agreement, if you want. I don't know the legal status of all that, but there's an agreement that right now on your website, you can indicate with some metadata, you can say which robots, which, you know, automated systems can actually access your data or not, right? So right now, and Google and other search engines will respect whatever you wish. So if you do not want to appear on Google, you can edit this little file and say, I don't want Google to, you know. And I imagine that something similar could happen with AI, right? Where the providers of these systems will have to honor the requests of people. Do not include me, you know? I think a lot of it is already written in the terms and conditions of the websites, but it doesn't have a common format. So when they collected all this data, it wasn't necessarily clear to them. However, we should also say that there's a lot of, you know, a lot of these systems, we know how to build them. They're not secrets, these LLMs. So anyone can build them. So if OpenAI decides not to browse that data, that doesn't, people don't want to, you know, they don't want it to be used for AI training. There could be other people who decide to, you know, behind the scenes, still create an LLM and use that data, right? Even if they're not authorized to do so. You can imagine a black market of LLMs.
So it's practically impossible to do anything, even if you wanted to.
Yeah.
If you're the author.
But again, it not necessarily, because you will have, so it depends on how much clout, how much power those companies like OpenAI have, you know, and they're, because you could, if you prevent the most famous or popular LLMs from using your data, then maybe it will work very well, even if there are some other hidden LLMs that are not being used, right? Because not respecting the rule, right? So I think it could have an effect, yeah.
If you'd publish
it could be a dark web, you know.
Right,
There are, you know.
You can do anything about that, yeah.
It could be a dark web of LLMs, but it doesn't mean that people will use them as much, you know. So, for example, if a company, let's say a serious company, wants to use an LLM for something, and they want to use a legitimate one, they will go to the providers that respect the rules, right? Because if they use an LLM that they found on the dark web that used a lot more data, then they could get sued for that potentially, or, you know. So I think this idea of preventing or having a common, you know, framework to decide or to tell others you can use my data or not to train them, to train AI, I think that that could be an outcome of all this.
Hmm. So if you publish your next book and you put a little footnote in the front, I don't want this book to be used by any LLMs, you think that's going to do?
Yeah. Speaking about books, that was something that they cite a lot, because there was a whole, you know, trial or something, like some law thing, some legal problem with Google Books a few years ago. And people now in AI, they're citing that because they say Google Books, it indexed the content of books so that people could find stuff in relevant books. And they're saying AI is the same. We're just indexing content, you know, but the thing, it was fair use. So the reason Google was still authorized to do this at that time was that they're not selling a product that competes against the books. They're actually trying to help you sell your book, right? By reading the content of the book, right? And that's why it was okay. It was determined that it was okay.
Interesting. Now, in a recent debate that you did, you said something very fascinating, also quite amusing. You said there's a lot of pressure within the industries to just use or cram in some sort of AI whenever possible, even if it doesn't make any sense within that context, because businesses don't want to be seen as old-fashioned. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can tell you a story of there was this this guy who works for a startup in the accounting field. They built accounting software. And he called me to say, look, I need you to help me find a use case, something we can do with LLMs, with ChatGPT, because we're trying to raise funding from a venture capitalist and we can't tell them that we're not using AI for something, right? So that they just wanted to put it in there, right? I've also seen companies hire a team of 60 people because they thought AI is cool. We need to do something with it. We don't know what, but we're going to put a team together to see what we can do with AI. And they just hire a lot of people. And they don't even know what they're going to build. They've never spoken with a potential user to the thing that they may build. So yeah, I think there's a lot of putting the cart before the horse in the industry. So AI is great. And they've been doing this for a long time. Even before the ChatGPT thing, I started speaking about this before that happened. It's stop with this whole, we need to be AI driven. Because it doesn't usually end well. You know, these projects tend to go wrong when you decide you want to use AI first, which is the opposite from good engineering, where you have a problem and then you find the solution for it. They do it the other way around. They have the solution. They're trying to find the problem for it. I think it happens a lot. Yeah.
So maybe all of those people that are going to be losing their jobs in various industries can maybe just go into AI and get themselves like a nice little corner in some office and then pretend to build some sort of AI machine to...
Yeah, I've been that person. And that's what made me write this book. I was very frustrated because I had a job where we had built a product. They built the product before I joined, but then I kind of improved the product. It was an AI-based product that didn't work, and it would never work because we didn't have the data necessary for it. It was just impossible to really have it do what it had to do.
May I ask what kind of industry this was?
So, no.
Okay, but fair enough.
I can tell you, because I've told a story in my book. I prefer not to share who they were.
Yeah.
But what I could tell you, it was a very big company you've heard of. And it was a product that tried to help executives make business decisions, important decisions, like firing people, you know, that kind of stuff. And they wanted to use AI for this because, hey, AI is, you know, the best. We need to do this in a data-driven way. And we want to have this AI system that will make recommendations for us. But the problem is that we didn't have data with enough scenarios, let's say, to actually be able to produce those recommendations. And they kind of made us fake it. Like, we kind of had to fake it. At one point, a colleague sent me an Excel file with results to just swap it with another file that I generated. Just like, let's pretend that these were the results, because the AI was outputting things that were pretty obviously not right. So we even added a layer outside the system to correct the outputs so that they match what executives had already kind of decided. So they had this tool that there's this AI giving them fake evidence to support the decisions that they made. Right. And so that was quite disturbing. We were in a meeting and this executive would say like, oh, but I used your system and it said that I should, you know, hire a team of 10 people here. But I actually downsized that branch of the business a few months ago. So I actually reduced the size. Why is this contradicting me? You know, and then my supervisors would be like, oh, there may be a bug in the system. Let's check. And then I kind of had to override the system to output what they wanted to hear.
Like retroactively, you're correcting its past wrong predictions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. We were doing that. And it was very disturbing. And I almost didn't work even at all because I had very little work to do because the system, everybody knew it was broken, but they had to keep the AI engineers around, you know, to pretend that we were building something amazing. They called me a rocket scientist once after I gave a talk presenting my system. They were like, it's like we're speaking with rocket scientists. And I was like, yeah, but I know that this actually doesn't work. So, and it was soul draining. And I remember I hated that job, you know, and it wasn't the first time it happened. I've seen this a lot, building products that don't work and then pretending a lot. And this was during COVID. And a lot of people, you can't resign. You can't quit a job right now because you don't know if you're going to find another job. You know, it's such a terrible time, you know. So I kind of followed that, you know. And at one point, after a long time, like almost a year and a half working for that company, I remember I saw a career coach. That's how confused I was because everybody told me, your situation is great. You barely work. You're paid good money. You know, everybody's losing their job. And I saw this career coach to help me, you know, this, you know, again, first world problems kind of thing. I saw a career coach and she told me, look, Emmanuel, it's absolutely normal that you feel really badly about this because you are being ethically compromised. It's actually a good thing that you want to quit this job. You know, not wanting to stay with it is a healthy thing, you know, that you want to leave. And then I resigned from that job. I got another one, which was very early on. I saw it was pretty much the same. It was like a temp project. It lasted a certain amount of time, but very early on, it's like, okay, you built this product. You thought it, because it happens a lot that people actually make mistakes. It's not on purpose. They build AI thinking. It makes great predictions because you're often biased toward finding, like if you give the wrong data to AI, you know, you may think it discovers something when it doesn't. And it was the situation. And I corrected the system and all of these amazing predictions were all bogus. They were not real predictions. The system was actually cheating to make those predictions. And I realized it was, again, the same story. And then I decided I'm going to take some time off. Because I've been stumbling upon these projects too many times. Not always. I've done some, you know, good work in AI where we build things that actually, you know, added value and stuff. And that's when I decided to write my book because I started gathering my thoughts, speaking with people. And I was like, I need the world to know that this field is completely overhyped. And behind every successful project, there are many. There are like maybe 100 that are like this, you know. And that's why I wrote the book. Yeah.
Did the Emperor's New Clothes moment kind of happen in any of these companies? Did you go like, I can't take it anymore. I got to tell them that this is all pretty much BS. Or were they didn't even want to be kind of awakened from that slumber?
It's a very good question. I tend to be as honest as I can, you know, in general. Yeah, I try to be quite transparent. There was one company where I can tell you where me and a colleague, so we both, we kind of found something fishy, something that was, this is not working the way we said it's been working, you know, and the team had been expanded based on these results. This is what happens a lot. You create a bad experiment. It shows that AI is great, even if it's not, but because everybody's biased toward, you know, they believe AI is going to solve every problem. The moment they see a little bit of evidence, they're like, oh, let's hire 15 more people. And then the team had grown. And then with my colleague, we find that probably the experiment was all the results are invalid, you know. And we approached the company. So we told, you know, our managers and we did bring kind of a solution. We also said, okay, we're going to propose a way to fix the experiment, to rerun it, because otherwise that's also something I noticed. If you just go and complain, and people don't take you very seriously. So you need to kind of come with a solution. And there was a bit of resistance at first, you know, from the company to actually fix it, because it was very, I think it was convenient not to fix it. And we put our foot down, you know, especially my colleague. She was very, very blunt. She was like, the only thing I'm going to do with these results is throw them out, put them in the garbage can. And then we managed to rerun the experiments, and the results were not as good as we thought they would be, but they were still okay. So AI was adding some value to the company. But I think you can meet resistance. And it depends on the company. Sometimes the problem is so deep that it's very hard for people to, you know, to do anything about it. And a lot of people, you know, I've met a lot of people that told me, look, I'm paying off my mortgage at the moment. I have three kids.
Of course.
I don't want to threaten my job, right? And I think that might be one of the reasons these projects last so long. When I worked for this company that I told you before, the one I resigned from and so the career coach and stuff. I went for drinks with colleagues after work, you know, once, and someone said, we haven't done anything of value in our team for 2 years. We've only outputted, you know, bullshit. When do you think they're going to scrap our team? Where are they going to get rid of our team? You know, so it was explicit. People knew. It was not like it was a secret that we hadn't done anything of value, you know? What I have seen is that after a while, these projects, they tend to fall into oblivion. So people don't want to explicitly acknowledge in a company, look, this was all a red herring. This was not working. We spent millions and millions. I've hired 70 people to do this. So they kind of let the team die away, you know, or they're just going to do maintenance, nothing new. And then people get bored and they resign and they don't replace them. Or they lower the budget, you know, assigned to a certain project for the next year. So that's why we also get such a survivorship bias, because you only hear about the great stories and all the other ones, they're swept under the rug. Yeah.
The title of your new book is Siliconed: How the Tech Industry Solves Fake Problems, Hoards Idle Workers, and Makes Doomed Bets, there we go, with Other People's Money. Great design. Yeah. What's the basic premise of this Silicon Valley con, would you say?
Yeah. Oh, I think the basic premise. So I think that the tech industry has a tendency to go crazy, you know, and overhire people, build products that don't make any sense. You know, lots of very weird behavior that you wouldn't be able to afford in other fields. So it happened in 2000, you know, 2000 with the dot-com bubble. It's happened again a few years ago, like a couple of years ago, with the whole unicorn boom. We see it with AI. We see it with blockchain, augmented reality. There's always like something going on. So I think it has a tendency to go crazy. And it's resulted in a lot of idleness. So a lot of people are not working at all, being hired by companies and not having anything to do. You know, and also a lot of work that was pointless. You know, build a product that is pretty obviously flawed, but you just still build it because it's an experiment and you have money for it. So why not? Yeah, that kind of thing. And I started speaking about this after, you know, having a few experiences of being hired to do nothing, and then seeing that a lot around me. At one point, I was like, what's going on with this industry? I have most of my friends in tech, they're not working. I have a friend who...
Damn, I need to get into tech. Maybe we can talk about after the interview a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. It's not as great as it seems. So that's also another point of the book. A lot of people are unhappy because you're a nerd. You want to build a cool product. You don't want to sit around pretending that you're working because you have to do a lot of that. It's not like you go on your scuba diving holiday. A friend of mine, he had two jobs at the same time secretly for 5 years. He's still doing it now. none of his employers knew about the existence of the other.
I like
one.
Him.
At one point, he had three jobs and he quit because it was a little bit too much in terms of meetings that clash. And it was a bit, yeah. And I looked around and a lot of people were in the same situation, you know, and I thought there's something going on with this industry that's not quite sustainable, because how can you afford to do this? Something is not, and it didn't last because then everybody got fired, right? Twitter fired 80% of its employees. There were massive layoffs. And then the investment in tech by venture capital collapsed in 2022 after a best year ever in 2021. So this book analyzes the causes of the recurring waves of craziness in technology. I've spoken with a lot of people, with investors, with economists, with venture capitalists, with entrepreneurs, to see what's going on. You know, I'll give you just one example of the silliness. As we speak now, we're in the middle of the Olympics in Paris,
yep.
Right? Or they're just starting. About a year and a half ago, I spoke with people in Paris who were telling me how they were building these, they call them vertiports, like vertical airports. It's basically landing pads for electric air taxis. Because they were hoping that these electric, they call eVTOLs, like these air taxis, like on air taxis, will be used, this futuristic thing, in the Olympics. And they used government money to build landing pads so that people could be transported from like the airport in Paris to the city center on an air taxi, completely futuristic. But at the time, so we're talking, when they started building this, the air taxis, they were prototypes. They couldn't even fly. They're still very dubious. They're still trying to build them. They have problems with the batteries being too heavy, you know. So they haven't built the successful air taxi yet. But at that time, when they decided to go and build these landing pads, it was very unlikely that in this the state things were in, like in a matter of a year or two, you will be able to build those air taxis. But not just that, give them regulated, pass regulation. Nobody yet knows what regulation is going to be like for air taxis, for electric air taxis. So imagine how crazy you have to be to actually build the landing pad. It's so obvious. The air taxis are not going to be flying in a year and a half from now. Like, why are you building this? And it was just like, I think a month ago, that this company starting announcing, oh yeah, by the way, we're not going to be able to fly the air taxis in Paris for the Olympics. Maybe in another event, like, I don't know, a year later, they just pushed the goalpost. But this is a sign of there's something wrong with the industry, right? Because resources are spent on things that are quite obviously very, very long shots, you know?
Let's maybe risk a sweeping prediction at the end, if we can. Do you think that with AI and where it's heading, we are really standing on the precipice of something monumental and extraordinary, something that will change humanity as we know it? Or is it mostly just smoke and mirrors?
So it doesn't have to be smoke and mirrors, because it could still, something good could come out of it. But my answer to your question is no. So I don't think this is a pivotal thing like the internet was.
Oh, really?
I'm answering.
Well, that's fascinating, because people are saying this is even more grand than the invention of the printing press or the internet.
Oh, absolutely not.
I've heard that over and over again.
I honestly don't see how. So the internet, to me, that was a pivotal change, right? Like, you can communicate with your family abroad instantly. Like, it's what the internet has done. I think it's really, really impressive for the way we live. I think AI, as it stands now, then if there's a discovery, we'll see. People are using it as an assistant. I don't see, but maybe I'm, you know, a Luddite or a bit old-fashioned, but I don't see how it's pivotal like the internet was. I still see people shopping the same way, doing many things the same way. I already see a lot of people disappointed from AI, because they're like, you know, I met a designer who was trying to illustrate something, and she was telling me, I can't get it to do exactly what I want, and it's now taking me longer to refine the prompt, and whenever I update something in the picture, there's something else that changed. I can't get it quite to do what I want. I will read the user manual, she told me. I will read the user manual. And like, yeah, but it's probably not going to help you, because that's how AI works. You kind of need to take the outputs the way they are, and you can edit them a little bit, but at some point, you know. Yeah, I think it might change the way we do certain things. You know, I see lots of coders, instead of going to Stack Overflow, which is this website where we always go to search for answers of things that don't work well. A lot of them, and I've done it myself, we just go to ChatGPT, you know, especially if you know the answer. If you know how to do something, but you forgot or you're lazy to type it out, you know, you're like, okay, let's just ask ChatGPT. And when I see the answer, I'm like, oh, I know this is right, you know, or I can validate it. But again, that's such a nice toy to have, but this is not going to change the way I work much, the way I live much. You know, I think if you want a wilder prediction, I think something's going on in the opposite direction, in the sense that people want more and more human content. And I will tell you an example of this. Maybe you do this too. Do you ever search something on Google and type Reddit afterwards?
All the time, especially the last 6 months. I'm not doing almost anything else.
Exactly. I am.
It's creepy how you called it out right now. Like, I feel like you were watching me for the past 6 months.
Yeah,
I thought I'm the only one doing that.
I pretty much only want to see results from Reddit. And actually, Google just did something very smart, which is they got exclusive access to Reddit. So now Reddit results will not be showing up on Bing and stuff. But the reason I think we are all doing this is that we want an honest answer from a human being. And on Reddit, we're pretty good at kind of telling what's authentic. So, you know, doesn't mean that stuff doesn't happen on Reddit, but I don't want to see all those blog articles that try to sell me something because I know they're not honest, right? If you want to know, is it worth visiting the Louvre Museum in Paris? Is it worth it for, you know, if you type that into like all the results from blogs, it's never going to be an honest answer. But if you go to Reddit, you can actually find insights from real people telling you, oh, it's amazing. However, if you have kids, they're going to get really bored. You know, you get this human touch, right? And I find this fascinating because the reason we're all, at least in the English speaking world, the reason we're all going to Reddit to search for stuff is because we're missing that human touch that all of these blog articles don't have. But then AI is producing that kind of stuff. It's always very polite answers. It's never curated. It doesn't have an honest opinion. So I think one of the biggest issues they might face at Google, you know, search engines, is that people will start, you know, using them as a portal to go into Reddit or into human opinions. There's a website called Snowheads here in the UK. It's all about skiing. I love to ski, and instead of using Reddit, for instance, I specifically type Snowheads because I want to know what people in that forum say about stuff. Is that ski resort worth visiting, or is it better than this other ski resort? I'm never going to get an honest answer from a travel website which is trying to sell me a package to go there. And I use Snowheads. But I'm telling you, my point is, it's not just Reddit. There are certain venues for different things. But there's a transition toward trying to find human content. But then you have all these people saying, AI will give you the answer. I won't ask ChatGPT if a ski resort is better than another one. I'm going to get a list of pros and cons of each that doesn't really tell me anything.
What a absolutely amazing take. We've come full circle after all this song and dance. We're just like, yeah, I'm gonna ask my mate if, you know, I should go see Wolverine versus Deadpool. I'm not going to ask ChatGPT or whatever. And it is, I do recognize it. makes me chuckle, to be honest, because this is not how I expected this conversation is going to go, but I like it. I like surprises, number one. And I like that it's kind of going in this direction. Last question, Emmanuel. Whenever there's news of AI development on social media, for example, on Instagram, at least the accounts that I follow, the most liked comments at the top are always like, no one asked for this. Why are they doing this? You know, dystopia is coming. People seem to not be that hot about the development of AI these days. Maybe I have a skewed view because I follow such sites. But I wanted to ask, in this vein, should we even develop AI further at all?
Well, I don't want to tell people what to do and what not to do.
You can. Right? On this podcast, you can tell them.
No, I wouldn't want to.
Okay.
So I think if people want to keep developing AI, they probably should. They should be free to do so. What surprises me sometimes is that the vocabulary of some people when they speak of this is what we should do to improve for in order to get to AGI, right, to artificial general intelligence, we need to do this, we need to do that. So sometimes I'm surprised. I heard this from researchers, from AI researchers. So they assume that it's like it's a desirable thing. So we need to find a way to make it happen, you know? And even though I don't want to tell them don't do that, I want to question that premise. Is that why do we have to do this in order to get to AGI? Why do you want AGI? What do you want to get from it? Is it because you watch the movie Her and you have this sort of fetish? Or do you actually think, you know, some people speak about productivity, you know, but is it really why you want AGI? Because you want to increase productivity? Because I don't think that's what it is. You know? So sometimes I wonder, why do you want AGI so badly? What's your goal? You know? So I think we need to question that premise potentially that it's desirable. You know, we need to question it. It doesn't mean that we need to forbid people from developing AGI. You know, there was at this point, there was this open letter where people tried to block development for six months.
Elon Musk and whoever signed it. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was a bit naive in the sense that you're probably not going to stop it anyway. And I also thought it was, do you have the right to tell people you should not research this or that? You know, but to me, so I mentioned nuclear fusion before, nuclear fusion power. The reason people have been trying to develop it is that they think it could be a great way of producing electricity, right? They kind of have a very good reason for it.
Also, potentially solving climate change, at least a part of it.
Yeah, yeah. See, exactly. So there's a greater goal, in terms of, carbon emissions, in terms of the safety involved, because they say it could be safer than nuclear fission, which is how current nuclear reactors. But there's a case for it, right? But with AGI, sometimes I wonder, I mean, there may be a case for it too, but what is the case these people make for it? Because sometimes it seems like it's just like a fetish, to be honest. It's like, we want this powerful machine. And they tell you, oh, it's going to increase productivity. And I'm like, oh, maybe yes. But is that really what you're up to? Sometimes I doubt it. And they do say things like, it's going to solve climate change, AGI. Is AGI the best way to do that, you know? So I would say let's question this absolute need for AGI, you know, without necessarily telling people not to do it.
That's a great way to conclude this conversation. Thank you so much, Emmanuel. I had a total blast.
Hey, guys, this is a tiny podcast. There's no sponsors, no production team, and no editors. It's just little old me. And as such, the pod is at the mercy of you lovely folks watching and listening. So please do subscribe on YouTube, follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Also, I don't want to sell you some stupid mug or something that you don't need. So if you can, and most of all, if you want, please support me on Patreon. Now, at this point, I have to express my eternal gratitude to the pillar of the Smart Cookies community, and that's my patrons on Patreon. As always, without you, comrades, this show wouldn't exist. You better believe it. So massive thanks to Strole, Aida, Mancian, Micha Medved, Medinho, Goran, Gordon, Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Taichi, Veronica, and Carmen. Thank you.